Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, of course, this evening our special guest is Kathleen Albrecht, who has written, along with her friend Liz McIntyre, a book called Spy Chips. And you'll certainly want to get it to understand what we're talking about tonight, because this is going to affect every person listening to this program. If it's perhaps so 4 or 5 months ago when we read about somebody who worked for the Veterans Administration who'd violated the protocols and taken home his computer, laptop computer, that had 27 million names of people who'd been in the military. Now, I got out of the military in 54. My son got out in 94, 20 years later. And but we both got letters from the Veterans Administration warning us somebody might have stolen our identity. And then, of course, later when the laptop computer was recovered from where, we don't know, why, we got another letter telling us that our identity probably hadn't been stolen, but we should be wary all the time. There's an organized program, you've seen those advertisements on television, where you have a man who talks like a woman and a woman talks like a man, and it's all about identity theft. Somebody's stealing your identity. And, of course, they don't tell you what the solution is, but, of course, we know that there are people out there who do have a solution to this problem. After all, if animals are lost or stolen, a little dog was recently lost, and, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, somebody found this little dog, and they analyzed him. He had a chip in him, and they were able to identify the owner, and in fact the people who made the chip actually were good enough to fly that dog back to their owner. Wasn't that a nice thing to do? And everybody knows how efficient the chips are. Now, of course, we're talking about chipping every animal in the United States. We're talking about making certainly driver's license with RFID chips in them, and all sorts of identification cards with RFID chips. In fact, RFID is going to solve all the problems of identification and make our life so much easier. In fact, there was a report recently where many young people were supposedly interviewed, and the vast majority of them would be quite willing to take a chip just to make it easier for them to purchase things in a store. Now, whether the report is true or not, I don't know. And I'm going to ask our guest what she thinks of that. But I think it's so vitally important that you understand that they're playing games with our minds. They're conditioning us to accept something that they want us to accept. And this is how a propaganda campaign works. Kathleen, thank you so much for being with us late at night.
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's good to be on your show. You're raising some very interesting issues. And you're right that this stuff has really been in the news in the last couple of weeks. There have been several major stories. I want to start by commenting, if I could, on the study that showed that young people in the UK would be willing to take a payment chip to make their payments in the store. They would have a chip implanted in their hand or in their arm. They would wave this payment chip in front of the cash register, voila, transfer a unique ID number that would be linked up to their accounts, pay for their groceries, and waltz out of the store. Well, we actually wrote a comment on this that was posted in several places on the Internet, including at News with Views, which essentially shows that study was misreported. And, in fact, we found that the young people were anything but willing to take a payment microchip. And I would be happy to I'll let people hang with that question and say, well, how did it get reported the other way if it turns out that people didn't want the chip? And I hear the music coming up. Maybe we can address that one after the break.
All right, we will. And I think it's so vitally important that people understand that we are victims of a massive, well-organized, coordinated propaganda campaign to get us to be chipped. Well, Kathleen, you go ahead and pick up the story. How was it the reporter just the opposite of what the truth was?
Well, you know what was interesting there is you have the British press, and it was actually in two different articles that they did this, essentially came out and said that people would, that the young people, according to studies that they did, people really want to get these chips. One of them was in the UK Daily Mail. And in fact, the headline proclaimed in big letters, "Young shoppers want to pay with chip in skin." However, when you actually read the article, what you found was that the study, the findings in that study, were that only 8%, that's 8% of the young people they surveyed said that they would be willing to get a chip. And in fact, 92% of them, the overwhelming majority, said no way. And what I thought was interesting was not that the fact that a small number of young people in the UK would agree to this, because I think you could probably get a small number of young people in the UK to agree with just about any outrageous thing. You could probably get 8% of people to agree with a lot of wrong ideas. But the fact that when 92% of people said no, that the British press thought to paint that in exactly the opposite light and instead emphasize the fact that people did want to do this. It was picked up by the Drudge Report. It was picked up by numerous news agencies and bloggers throughout the world, actually. And I, looking at that 8% figure, I did a little bit of poking around on the Internet, and this is actually on our blog at spychips.com. But what I wrote there was, assuming there was some real news here, how significant is it that 8% of teens said they'd get a payment chip? Just for kicks, I looked around the net at other studies of UK teens and found a few interesting statistics. So 8% said they would get a payment implant, but another survey shows that 20% of UK teens are experiencing psychological problems at any given time, and nearly a third of UK college students have contemplated suicide at some point in their lives. Of course, contemplating suicide to me seems a lot more dramatic than considering a chip implant, yet we don't read these big headline stories proclaiming that UK youth are lining up in droves to kill themselves. But it gets even more interesting. I found that a third of UK teens reported vandalizing property in the last year, a quarter of them reported shoplifting, 40% had binged on alcohol, and half of them reported committing at least one criminal act. So in other words, basically what these studies are finding is that teens, as we know, in the UK as here in the United States, are still trying to find their identity, are still trying to express themselves and figure out what the basic rules of social behavior are, and they frequently make mistakes and harm themselves in the process. So the amazing part to me about this study was that more teens didn't agree, even on paper, even in theory, to get a chip.
We'll be right back in just a moment here with Kathy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Catherine had pointed out that the study that we had heard about about how the teenagers were willing to actually accept the chip, the vast majority of the teenagers wanted the chip, something of the sort. Actually, the study came out of England, and the vast majority of the teenagers in Great Britain did not want the chip. 8% said they'd be willing to take a chip. 92% said they were against it. And yet, of course, all we heard was that they were willing to take the chip. They didn't mention, of course, it was only 8%. And then, as Catherine pointed out, almost a third of teenagers in Great Britain have contemplated suicide, and only 8% are willing to take the chip. So there's something seriously wrong with the statistics, and so many of the young people have been into vandalism and shoplifting and just a mixed-up generation. In fact, Catherine's point, I think, is well made. With a third of them contemplating suicide and many of them involved in shoplifting and vandalism, I think it's amazing that only 8% of these confused kids would be willing to take a chip. So go ahead and pick up this story.
Well, and think about it too, Dr. Stan. If this is in theory, they're not actually looking at that big hypodermic needle coming at them to puncture their skin in what is actually a pretty gruesome implantation process. I mean, this is just on paper. I'm betting that even those 8%, if they actually had to face the reality of having it done to them, would probably be an even smaller percentage. We kind of tongue-in-cheek concluded this commentary by saying what it boils down to is, statistically speaking, UK teens prefer suicide over chip implants.
Know if they should laugh at that or cry.
But it's so ludicrous, and especially this headline. We were thinking the headline should probably say instead, "I'd sooner kill myself than get chipped." So, even in this this world where the media would portray everyone as lining up in droves, is perfectly willing to go along with this chipping agenda when you actually look at real people responding to, you know, to these questions. Would you actually get chipped? Older people are even less likely to say yes. In fact, they found that only 5%, in other words, 95% of adults said, no way, Jose, I don't want a chip. Forget about it.
And I think, of course, what the people have to understand is we hear all this talk about illegal immigrants coming into the country. What's the solution? How can we tell whether they're legal or illegal? Why, the chip is the best way to do it. We hear all the talk about the danger of Islamic terrorists. Islamic terrorists, they're every place, they're ready to attack us. And what we need to do is, of course, we need to know who should be here, who is an American citizen, who is not. The obvious solution is everybody have a chip. In fact, they have passed some of the most draconian legislation I have ever heard, and maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about this legislation that is going to require by the year 2008.
Well, you're right, because the industry that is promoting this idea of chipping people is really pushing that scare button, because if you can get people frightened, if you can say to people, hey, it's not you I want to chip, it's that guy over there, then you can get people much more willing to go along with it. In fact, right after reporting on this story where 92% of UK teens said no to chip implants, I looked up a different study that was conducted about 6 months ago about the idea of chipping immigrants, and this was actually done through a television station had commissioned this study out of Las Vegas, Nevada. And what they found, and I was stunned to see this, was around 30% of people in Las Vegas said that they did believe that immigrants should be chipped. So isn't that interesting that you have a, as long as you can point the finger at that guy over there, as long as you can say, well, you know, don't put it in me, don't put it in my family or my people, but put it in that guy over there. And so I believe the industry is very, they're savvy people. They've spent quite a bit of money on marketing. They've lost millions of dollars trying to promote this product, and they're getting more savvy. Now, what goes into effect in 2008 is sort of the other level of ratcheting up the fear, which is saying that we need to put one of these chip implants into every food animal in the United States to keep track of animal outbreaks and animal diseases.
And I think that this is, of course, they're going to protect us from mad cow disease or, they created all this fear about the spinach conspiracy or the lettuce conspiracy. And, my goodness, there might be some E. coli in something, and one or two children died, and this is a tragedy. But you notice how they kept playing this up day after day after day after day after day. Now, the E. coli outbreak, and certainly we've always had some outbreaks of contaminated food down through the years, but this one I don't think I've ever seen as much emphasis on it. But then, of course, this whole idea of chipping every animal, we're talking about chickens, we're talking about geese, we're talking about goats, is because there was a case of mad cow disease, or maybe even two cases in the United States. That's why we've got a chip. Every animal in the United States and every little chicken who's born in hats in this country. And tell us about this incredible legislation.
Well, it's called the National Animal Identification System, or NAIS. And you can find out more on the Internet if you just do a quick search for NAIS, or if you go to a website run by a farmer out of Vermont named Walter Jeffries. He runs a website at nonais.org. Where he's just got a wealth of information on there. But essentially what happens come January 2008 is not only do you have to chip all farm animals in this country, meaning every cow, every goose, every chicken, every goat, every sheep, every horse has to have a unique ID number assigned to it. There's really no other alternative to having a chip implant short of having an RFID-based ear tag implanted in the animal. And what's worse is you are required as a small farmer or even as someone who's dwelling in the suburbs but has a chicken or two, you are required to report within 24 hours to the United States Department of Agriculture anytime an animal is born or an avian animal hatches. You have to report anytime that animal moves onto or off of your property. You have to report when you change ownership of one of those animals or when you slaughter or consume one of those animals. So this means even if your cow makes a hole in the fence and wanders over into your neighbor's yard, you will be legally obligated to report that incident on a file that will be kept and maintained by the federal government. If you fail to do so within 24 hours, you will be fined $1,000 per incident. And if you can imagine, you have a whole brood of chickens hatch all at once and you fail to report that, you could be in the hole for many thousands of dollars. And the small farmers really say, we don't have time to be filling out this paperwork, but what's even more crucial is it's really not the government's business to keep track of where all the food is in this country, because that's really what this boils down to. This is a food registration program.
And there's not only, of course, your animals, then they want you to tell where you have the grain and the other things stored, don't they?
Yes. One of the other things you have to do by January 2008 is you have to fill out a premises identification form and be issued a premises ID number. And what the government then does is they take a geospatial satellite image of your property, and on that image you have to tell them where your animals are sleeping, where they live, where they roam, where they graze. You have to tell them where the grain or the feed that you feed the animals is stored. And you also give them tacit permission simply by having the animals and by virtue of being in the country. This regulation gives USDA officials the right to enter your property without a warrant and without your permission at any time to inspect your animals and to inspect their feed and to ensure that you are doing things properly, that all of your animals are numbered and tagged. It provides severe penalties for anyone who modifies a tag or who removes a tag from an animal, and provides severe penalties for failing to register all of this information in a timely manner with the USDA.
Well, now, how could any person who's a very, very small chicken, maybe they have 100 chickens, I mean, you're going to have the veterinarian come out to tag those animals, chickens, or you're going to have to take them down to the veterinarian. What's it going to cost for the veterinarian fees, what it's going to cost for the RFID chip, and every one of those, what's it going to cost, to fill out all the paperwork for each chicken as they're hatched? They're not all going to be hatched in one day, so you're going to have to, of course, take the chickens down every day or have the veterinarian out there every day. And what's a chicken worth? Probably, $6 or $8 at the most? I mean, this sounds to me like a losing proposition, and what it's going to do is to force our small farmers out of work. This sounds like something you might find in communist China or the old Soviet Union, but in America?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the biggest objections to this program, is that it provides very generous exceptions to factory farmers. And if we back up a little bit and think about what the cause of many of these animal diseases, these E. coli outbreaks, and these other problems that we're facing in our food supply, they almost inevitably involve large factory farm situations where there's not the attention paid to the hygiene, where it's more an issue of efficiently raising as many animals as possible in as small of a space as possible. These animals frequently live in very unsanitary conditions where diseases are rampant. In many cases, they'll simply douse them with antibiotics. They'll literally hose them off because they're so close together and in such tight quarters. They'll incorporate the antibiotics into the feed. And these animals really would be horribly diseased without all of this intervention. Many of them actually are diseased. So in this factory farming condition is where you wind up with these terrible diseases that spread into the food supply. You don't see things like foot and mouth disease, mad cow disease, avian flu. You don't see these things on small, well-run family farms. Typically on farms like that, the farmer knows each animal by name. The farmer is out there in the shed at 2 a.m. as the ewes are lambing and the young animals are being born. But the small farms are the ones who have to register each individual animal. The factory farms who produce these animals in bulk only have to provide a single number for the entire herd. So they may have 1,000 cows with one number, and they only have to register one report when all of those cows are transferred or slaughtered, not 1,000 individual reports like a small farmer would have to do.
Sounds to me like an excellent means of doing away with the opposition or the competition, doesn't it?
Well, I think that's why there's been a lot of support by the factory farms. They've been the biggest backers of this plan.
And, of course, if you want to do away with your competition, well, you get the federal government to do it. How would you like to be a little farmer? I have to abide by these rules. Well, you know, this really is such draconian legislation, and yet I don't think the average citizen, unless they listen to a program such as this or read your material, has any idea what the farmer faces. Why aren't the farmers across America up in arms about this?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons, Dr. Stan. One of them, you hit the nail on the head, is people are not aware that this is happening. That's actually one of the objections to the time frame that the opponents to NAACP have raised, is that at present, an extraordinarily small percentage, some say it's less than 10%, of farmers across this country are aware that these regulations have been passed and have been enacted and will be enforced as little as just a year and a couple of months from now. So there's broad-scale lack of awareness of this program. I think that's one reason that you're not hearing a great outcry from the farmers, because the farmers don't know this is happening. I think the other reason is if you think about farmers generally, there are factors sort of in play here that would keep them from rising up and revolting, and also that would make it difficult for them to comply with the program, kind of the same problem. And that is that many of these people are in rural, isolated areas. They've chosen a lifestyle which does not put them in daily contact with the Internet. Many folks living on farms and in rural communities have chosen not to have Internet connections at all, or maybe not own computers at all, kind of a back-to-the-land, old-fashioned approach to living. Many of these folks have chosen to live off the grid, or they've chosen to live out of the mainstream cities specifically because they wanted to get away from these kinds of government programs and Big Brother interventions. So I think that on the one hand means that this community is less likely to become aware of government decisions that impact them, simply because they're not typing onto the Internet and they're not poking around through websites as someone someone who's a little more tuned into that environment would do. And then second of all, though, that they're unlikely to even become aware of these requirements when they go into effect. There is no provision in the NAACP regulations for ignorance. Just like anything else, they say ignorance of the law is no defense. If the USDA comes around in 2009 and they find that, here's someone living on the land who has, a dozen or so livestock animals and has not reported them, that individual could be right on the spot subjected to a tremendous fine for failure to comply. And, as we know, when you put a big enough fine on someone, if they can't pay it, then the government comes in and confiscates your property. So we could actually see 2009, 2010, a wide-scale reapportionment of rural land as it is taken from the hands of people who are non-compliant with these NAACP regulations and turned over into the hands of the federal government. And, of course, that land would be auctioned off and would probably wind up in the hands of the big agribusiness concerns that are doing this factory farming in the first place.
Well, now, what about horses? Would horses be included in this as well?
They are, and that's one of the dogs are not included in the current version of the regulations. Horses are.
How about cats?
Cats are not.
Oh, dogs. So dogs and cats.
Yeah, horses are pretty much the only what we would consider a non-food based animal that would be chipped. But horses are particularly interesting because you are required to report whenever the animal leaves your property. So many people have horses because they like to ride their horses.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Catherine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking about this legislation that has already been enacted into law. But, of course, Rush Limbaugh isn't going to tell you about that. This legislation has been, of course, is going to require that if you have 10 chickens, every one of them is going to have a chip. If one of those chickens gets loose and gets in your neighbor's yard, you have to report that to the government. And then, of course, comes the subject of horses. Now, let's imagine you have a horse. Of course, a horse is going to have to be chipped. I mean, that's you're not a lawbreaker, are you? I mean, you want to cooperate with our government that's busy fighting the evil terrorists and protecting our freedom over there in the Middle East. And so, of course, you've got to go along with the government. But one of the interesting things Catherine brings out is that if your horse was to leave your property at any time, for instance, you want to take it riding someplace, you have to report that to the government according to this legislation?
every single time your horse leaves the gates of your property, you are required to fill out a form and submit that form to the United States Department of Agriculture or face a $1,000 fine for noncompliance. So I happen to live in a fairly rural community where people have a lot of horses. In fact, a lot of the properties in my community are equestrian properties, and they're either, you know, horses that are for farm use or horses that are for riding purposes. And people take those horses out in horse trailers all the time, or they go for rides, and sometimes literally driving down my street, there will be someone riding a horse on a nice Sunday afternoon. All of those individuals would be required to report to the government anytime they leave their property with that horse.
And so everything will be regulated by the government, but how is the government going to keep track of that? I mean, there's no way they can keep track of all this paperwork. Is this going to be done by computer? Is it going to be done on paper? How is it going to be done? And of course, for the people who don't have computers, they're going to have to be filling out those forms, and then, of course, it's going to have to be mailed in, and it's going to take days before it gets there many times.
Well, that's exactly the problem. The USDA is suggesting that they will have a website where people will be able to log on with their uniquely assigned premises ID number, and they will be able to report the numbers of their animals. Obviously, this will be much easier for the factory farmers. As you take your 1,000 head of cattle to the slaughterhouse, you simply have to record that one single lot number that represents all of those cattle and fill out one single form on the Internet. For people with more animals, obviously, or small farmers with less animals, even if you have 5 or 10, you will be forced to fill out 5 or 10 different unique individual reports. And, yes, if you don't have access to the Internet, there will have to be provisions made for people to fill out paper forms and fill those in as well. I believe in terms of the reporting date, as long as you have it postmarked within 24 hours of the event, you will be covered by these regulations. But, you know, nevertheless, it's pretty dramatic. You know, there's another part of these regulations that I was stunned to read, and that had to do with people entering and leaving your property. You're actually required, as of this date when this goes into effect, to keep a log of the visitors onto your property. And presumably the idea is if there's later shown to be an outbreak of an animal disease on your property, the government would be able to go back and contact each of those individuals and see if they had dirt on their shoes from your farm that they might have tracked into some other place and track down the vectors for the disease. What I found shocking about this is if you are, you know, a grandmother or a farmer, you're living out in the country, you have your grandchildren over for Thanksgiving, you have your extended family over, you make a nice meal, you will have to report and record. Well, you don't have to report it yet, but you will have to record in a logbook the identity of every single person who's entered your property. And, in fact, in one version of the regulations, it even recommends taking photocopies of everyone's driver's license who enters your property. So this not only means that the government will be able to keep track of all the food in the country, but it means that the government will also have the means of assessing who has been traveling and interacting with people who live in rural communities and who have livestock. So, that to me raises a whole other specter of the idea that when I have Thanksgiving dinner and I have, you know, 10 people over to my house, I'm going to have to stop them at the door and say, excuse me, I need to photocopy your driver's license and write down your date of birth before I can let you into the dining room.
Why would the Republican-controlled Congress and Senate, at a Republican, the president sign such draconian regulations that, of course, are going to allow government monitoring of everything that the farmer is doing? I mean, even who comes onto their farm. This is incredible.
Well, and, you know, I think under the Democrats we'll fare just as badly, but I think they'll want to register a whole different set of our experiences of life. So, you know, I've gotten past the Democrats or the Republicans seeming to have different agendas, because watching the last few administrations, they seem to all have the same agenda, and that agenda seems to be numbering and tracking us and all we do.
And I think you're absolutely right. I don't think there's a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. I just wish we could get some gridlock in Congress so that nothing would get done, for, as Mark Twain had said, the only time you're purse or property are safe is when Congress is been adjourned. Well, Catherine, you know, we talk about this. I'm sure many of our listeners out across America are shaking their heads and saying, this couldn't be true. I mean, this couldn't happen in America. And yet, of course, we're told that the government is here to protect us. And that is what the president said. You know, I was elected to protect you, and that's what I'm doing. But it doesn't seem like this is really protecting it. It's almost as if it's a pattern of harassment of the people. What possible good is this going to do? I mean, with one or two cases of mad cow disease in the entire nation, how does this justify chipping all the chickens?
Well, and in fact, mad cow disease is a great example of a problem that this would not cure. We've actually found through research around mad cow disease that it is not a disease that is transmissible by someone leaving or entering a property or by an animal moving from one property to another. It's not contagious in that way. Otherwise, you'd find entire herds breaking out with it. Mad cow disease is actually transmitted because of these horrible factory farming practices whereby they look for the cheapest feed possible, and they've been grinding up diseased cows and feeding them because they're not fit for human consumption. They don't want to throw them away and waste the money. They actually, for a period of time, were grinding up these animals and turning them into feed for other cows. And, you know, common sense, just common sense tells you that feeding a diseased cow to another cow might actually cause that second cow to become ill. And that's exactly what they found, is if you feed brain tissue or spinal column tissue from an animal that has contracted mad cow disease to other animals, then through that means of actually consuming that diseased tissue, those other animals can become sick. So registering the individual animals and keeping track of where they move would not have any effect on that disease at all. And in fact, the way we've curtailed mad cow disease is by passing some pretty strict regulations about what can be put into animal feed. So no longer can they take, for example, chicken excrement, which they used to grind up and put into other animal feed and into even chicken feed, and literally be feeding chickens their own waste products. That's no longer permissible. It's no longer permissible to put, diseased cows into cow food, et cetera. So by paying more attention to how we're feeding these animals in these factory farm conditions, we can cut down a lot of these diseases in a way that I think is much more efficient than causing every small farmer in America to have to, essentially report very intimate details of their farming lives.
Well, I think this is really an incredible piece of legislation. And, of course, did Congress actually vote for this, or was this?
No, and in a way, I wish Congress had. This is
hold
one
that
of the...
thought. Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Catherine Albrecht, and of course, her book is Spy Chips, and we carry the book. But, Catherine, I want you to give your website, how people can get your information off the Internet or by other means before we go on.
Yeah, our website is, of course, our book is called Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. In that book, we detail plans to place tiny RFID microchip tracking devices not only in animals and people, but also in everyday items like shoes and clothing. We've actually found them embedded in clothing labels. We've found them hidden in Gillette razor products and other items. And we detail the industry's plan to essentially track and number every physical object on Earth by replacing the barcode with these remotely trackable spy chips or RFID tags. That book, again, is called Spy Chips. You can order it through Dr. Stan. You can also find it at local bookstores and on our website. And for people who would like to follow this but are either not big readers or not in a position to buy a book right now, you can find a tremendous amount of information on our website at spychips.com. That's www.spychips, all one word with an S, .com. On our website, we have a free newsletter that we encourage people to sign up for. We send a news item up approximately once or twice a month. You'll get an update of the latest information of what's happening in the world of tracking and RFID. And again, that website is at spychips.com. On that website, when you do sign up for our newsletter, you'll get an opportunity to provide feedback if you'd like to, and those feedback forms wind up directly on my desk, so that's the best way to communicate with me directly.
of Catherine, you were actually going to Harvard, weren't you? Were you writing a master's thesis or a doctoral thesis?
Yeah, I actually have a doctorate in consumer education from Harvard University. I just finished up in June, so I'm actually Dr. Albrecht now.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. After many years, the focus of my dissertation research at Harvard was actually looking at supermarket frequent shopper cards. And this all stems from my concern, which goes all the way back to 1999 when I founded Caspian, which is the worldwide organization with over 12,000 members that I had. That organization is called Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And back in 1999, I became concerned that the food supply was getting increasingly regulated and monitored by the powers that be. Back then, it was in the form of the supermarket cards, the frequent shopper cards that people scan to shop at the grocery store. And essentially what those cards do is they serve as a food registration system. When you buy food and you scan your card, you're essentially giving the store and the government or anyone else it intends or is willing to share that data with a very detailed record of your family composition and food that your family eats. And I thought, how offensive that we are being pressured in the form of higher prices, in the form of no longer getting discounts on our grocery shopping, unless we comply with this numbered card and provide our personal information to the stores, we're not able to buy food at reasonable prices. And then, of course, Dr. Stan, you and I both remember that, you know, prior to about 1990, every store in the country had sales. You just walked in the door and things were on sale and you got the sale price by being a customer and having greenbacks in your hand. You didn't have to join a club or sign up for some kind of monitoring program to take advantage of those discounts. And nowadays those discounts come with the strings attached. So there was no benefit whatsoever to the consumer in essentially paying the same sale price as they'd paid all along but now registering their purchases.
Because what they really were doing was they were jacking up the price and then cutting it if you had a card, and you were paying just about the same price, or maybe even a little bit more than you would pay if you had just gone to a grocery store without one of these cards. And it's all a scam, but you have to understand that our minds are being molded, our tastes are being formed, our ideas being suggested by, of course, men we've never heard of. We're being conditioned to go along. Oh, isn't it wonderful? Now we've got this grocery card and we get cheaper prices. And the truth of the matter is, you're probably paying more.
Yeah, we actually did studies and found that people are paying more. We did studies, two different types of studies. One, we compared stores with cards and stores without cards on overall pricing. And we found not only us, but also the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and some other journalists went out and did similar studies. And in every case, they found that the prices were lower at the card-free stores than they were at the card stores, even taking advantage of the so-called card discounts. So you'll find that the everyday prices on other objects in the store are so much higher that it more than compensates for the discounts you get on the discounted items. The second kind of study we did was we looked at individual stores before and after the card went into place, and we looked at the sale prices at those stores, and we found that on average, after the card went into place, now here you're required to carry this plastic numbered card, you're using a number to buy food, you're registering your food in a database, and you are on average paying between 1% and 2% more to buy your food under those circumstances than you were just weeks before when the store, prior to the store introducing the cards. And that's because we were able to follow the introduction of these programs at stores around the country as it occurred. And we found that in virtually every case that the savings were illusory. One case stands out in my mind. This was a Kraft Philadelphia, not Philadelphia cream cheese, Kraft Cheese Whiz that actually had right on the box manufacturer suggested retail price $3.99 or $4. If you had your card, this is at a store in Waco, Texas, of all places. If you had the way they had priced this cheese, which said right on the box, manufacturer suggested retail price $4, is it was $6 was the store's everyday low price. But if you scanned your card, you'd get a whopping $2 off, which would bring the price right down to, you guessed it, $4. So what that means is that the people with the card were given the privilege of paying the regular price. The people who refused to scan a card were charged a 50% surcharge or a full $2 more on an item that should have cost $4. They were charged $6.
Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Catherine, is 888-24-LIBERTY. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I was asking Catherine, you know, where did this legislation come from that is going to require all farm animals or horses or cows or even little chickies to be, of course, chipped? And, you know, what can we do? Can we, of course, bring pressure to bear upon our, certainly on our elected representatives to repeal this legislation? And Catherine pointed out, this was never enacted by our elected representatives. So why don't you pick up that idea? Because I think it's so vitally important that our listeners understand that today so much of the legislation that we're forced to live under is simply created by a faceless bureaucracy. Nobody is responsible. Nothing can be done about it. The legislators didn't pass it. We seem to have an unelected rulers who are determining what's good for us. So pick up that story.
Yeah, that's actually one of the big problems. If legislators had passed this, we could vote them out of office. But given that the United States Department of Agriculture, which is essentially a big bureaucracy, we don't elect USDA officials to serve in their post and to pass these sorts of regulations, and yet their pronouncements have the force of law. Without being voted on by our elected officials, without going through Congress and the President and the normal system of lawmaking that was put in place by the founding fathers of this country. We are finding that many of these government agencies, everything from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, all of these big government agencies have the power to enact unilaterally these sorts of regulations that essentially have the force of law. They can put enforcement provisions in place. They can put penalties in place. They can enforce their penalties through fines and in some cases through imprisonment. So they have tremendous power, and yet we have no ability to impact their decisions or to vote on them. Case in point is when the decision was made by the State Department to incorporate RFID tags into passports. This is actually as of October of this year, this month. All U.S. passports issued from here in from here on will contain a spy chip, will actually contain one of these insecure RFID tags. Now, when the State Department decided to do this, they opened up a comment period, and they received several thousand comments, which to their own admission, 98.5% of those comments were opposed to the idea of putting RFID tags in passports. People don't like the idea of doing that, and they spoke very vocally and in large numbers against it. The State Department, acknowledging the fact that the vast majority of comments it received opposed it from regular Americans, went ahead and did it anyway. Now, if this had been put to a vote, it never would have passed. But because the State Department is under no obligation to follow the will of the public or to do anything whatsoever with those comments, short of publish them and write a report about them and acknowledge their existence, they were able to move forward and do exactly what they wanted.
So much about government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It seems like we have a government of the bureaucracy, for the bureaucracy, and controlled by the bureaucracy, and we really don't care what the people think, but as long as they're willing to go along with it, it'll continue. Let's go to Herb, who's calling from, is that Tulsa, Oklahoma, Herb?
Yeah, my name is Herb, and yes, it is Tulsa.
All right, did you have a question?
Yes, I was wondering, are we going to have to chip our pets like our dogs and cats, and what about the Amish and Mennonites?
Great, great question, sir. Right on target. As far as chipping dogs and cats, not under the NACE program, because dogs and cats are not considered to be food animals under this program. The only exception to the food animal rule there is horses, because the idea, I guess, is that horses could leave the property and track, disease-laden dirt around or something. As far as dogs and cats go, though, there are a couple of precedents that I think are worrisome. One of them is that the unincorporated areas of Los Angeles County, the Board of Supervisors has voted and is now enforced in law that everyone living in that area of Los Angeles County must microchip their dogs or face a $200 fine if they fail to do so. So that is already in place in at least one part of the country. I know that The legislature of Chicago, Illinois, had considered a similar move about a year ago. I believe that's been tabled for now, but that could come back at any point. And the other thing is, in New Zealand, all dogs in the country of New Zealand are now required by law to be microchipped, including farm dogs. And in fact, the farmers came out in force and objected to that, and I believe they may have gotten an exception for working farm dogs. But there is a move afoot, you're absolutely right, to require the chipping of dogs at a minimum. The chipping, there's several reasons for that, but one of them is if they pick up these animals at the pound, they want to be able to know who they belong to. But a subtle sort of background of that, or a side effect of that, is that essentially it gives the government a registry of where people are when they move and where they're living. Because if you can be tracked through your dog, if you're required to register your dog in a federal database, then when you move, you are required to tell the government that you've moved, where you're living. I mean, there's really no other program that forces you to tell the government where you are. But if they can do it through your animal, they've kind of got you.
Yeah, they really are pretty clever, aren't they? Well, let's go to Dan, who's calling from Coeur d'Alene. Dan, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I live in Spokane County, and we're registered or required to chip our animals. In fact, my dog is microchipped. And so if they're lost, they can be...
Oh, do you have a question? Please turn off. Can you turn off the radio there? Because it's a
great... Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. I was just going to say, as far as I have, like, a Safeway card, which I'm assuming is sort of the card you're talking about, I've never received anything from Safeway, like, that they know where I live. Am I being documented through them, do you think?
Yeah, Safeway actually has extensive documentation on people's purchases. Every time you scan that card, they are keeping a longitudinal record over time of all of your purchases. So they know what Safeway stores you shop at, they know what time you shop, they know which stores you frequent and when, they know what brand of toilet paper you buy and how much orange juice you consume. You may say, who cares, it doesn't matter, but let me tell you a story here about a chain in New England. Our biggest chain is called Stop and Shop. And a couple years back, I was chatting at a meeting with the vice president of IT for Stop and Shop, a man named Kurt Avalon. And he acknowledged that Stop and Shop has paid $3 million for a program, a computer program, that can convert all of their shopping records on their customers into individualized nutritional profiles. They can actually pull down a menu and pick any individual in the store, any shopper they have, and figure out how much green leafy vegetables or red meat they've been eating. And as a result of those nutritional breakdowns, they can predict your health. So they can actually say, is this person at greater risk for diabetes, for heart disease, for hypertension, for, whatever it is they're looking at. Now,
I'd love to have that information so I could change my diet.
Your right rather than somebody else's. Or do you not very concerned about somebody and knowing everything about you?
Oh, I don't think that there's any way that anybody cares.
Okay, they're keeping dossiers on every citizen in America. You may not be concerned about that. I am.
Who's doing that?
Let me point something out on that. That information is not available to you as the customer. In fact, the customer is not even aware that that program exists or that those analyses are being run. When I asked Mr. Avalon what they plan to do with that data, he said they would like to recoup their $3 million investment by sharing that data with HMOs. And if you think about that for a minute, your HMO does not have to tell you that it is monitoring your diet and making decisions about your health care as a result of that. They could decide to cancel your policy, to raise your rates, or to deny you coverage for particular health procedures and not even tell you why.
Well, of course, Dan's comment was, well, I'd like to know what my profile is so I could change my diet. Well, why would you have to do that? You know what you're buying. Well, I would think that you'd be, you would want to change your diet and live healthy anyway, rather than have somebody collecting a dossier on you. But the question then was asked is, who's keeping these dossiers? The military, the Army is keeping dossiers on all of our citizens in this country. And we have this, of course, from a book that was written by Major General William Odom, where, of course, he was head of NSA in a 2004 book. He can't tell us what they're doing, but he's a patriot, so he wanted to get around the restrictions that are placed on him because of the secrecy documents he has actually signed. But he commented, should the military, the Defense Department, be keeping dossiers on American citizens? Why do they want to do that? They want to control everybody. This is part of a pattern of control, and I am deeply concerned. Other people may say we've got nothing to fear from the government. I think we have everything to fear. If you go up on the Internet, you can look into some of these programs, at the TAPS program. In fact, they had one program that was established there, and their logo was a pyramid capped by an all-seeing eye looking out over the globe. Did you ever see that, Catherine?
I did. That's the Total Information Awareness Program through the Defense Department that wanted to keep tabs on every electronic transaction by every American, every phone call, bank deposit, supermarket purchase, you name it.
Yeah, and absolutely. That. So I'm concerned about that. Now, some people may think that, gee, isn't that great the government's so concerned about it. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff, did you have a quick question for our guest?
Yes, I did, Dr. Albright. Do you think that callers like Dan would be a bit upset, possibly, if we experienced a terrorist attack, for example, and the government had access to everybody that didn't take the new anthrax vaccine, for example?
Yeah, well, I think that that's one of the reasons the government wants to keep tabs on this kind of information.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program. Catherine, go right ahead.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons the government wants access to this information. You know, one of the things that concerns me the most and has driven my research and my work is this idea of access to food. And as I've pointed out on previous programs, Dr. Stan, you know, if people don't understand the folly of giving their government control over something as fundamental and basic a necessity as food, then they haven't studied 20th century history. And if you do study 20th century history, you will see that people's own governments were six times more deadly than all of the century's wars combined. Government is the most deadly force on the planet, short of natural causes. So if you're concerned about terrorism, if you're concerned about you know, E. coli in your spinach, you're worried about the wrong thing. Where you need to be concerned is the fact that, you know, if you give a government too much power, it will become abusive, it will begin to misuse that power, and ultimately governments turn bad and they begin harming their own citizens. And one of the ways they do that is through control of the food supply, plain and simple. We should not give that up and not give that into the hands of the government.
And, of course, the trouble is there's a lot of people out there say, well, I trust my government. Well, let me tell you that the Chinese government, which incidentally we put in power back in 1915, the Chinese Communist government liquidated between 41 and 43 million people, their own people, between 1958 and 1962. They simply starved them to death. Now, most people have never heard of that. You can go up on the Internet, type in the Great Hunger, and then ask yourself, I think that, you know, they use a figure of 30 million, but the figure is actually between 41 and 43 million. How could that happen without anybody ever hearing about it? And I would like to suggest that somebody does control our reality. Let's go quickly to David, who's calling from Coeur d'Alene. David, did you have a quick question? David, are you there? Or who's on the line? Well, I guess we must have lost David from Coeur d'Alene then.
You know, while we're waiting for our next caller, let me just address a quick question that came up from Herb that I didn't get to about the Amish. The Amish are actually prohibited from participating in this system, and provisions may actually be made for the Amish on this front. It's interesting, but there are many religious beliefs that think it is wrong to implant microchips into animals and to participate in these kinds of government monitoring systems. So religious objection may actually be one potential avenue to get out of this NACE complaint.
We'll have to then, of course, join the Amish or join the Mennonites, one or the other, and that's really been such a bad alternative. We're out of time, Catherine. As always, it's always a pleasure to have you with us here at Radio Liberty.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. People, swing by and check out spychips.com and drop us a line. We'd love to have you join our organization, and thank you for all that you're doing, Dr. Stan, to spread the word.
God bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, of course, that was Catherine Albrecht. I hope you enjoyed the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we recommend Catherine's book. We carry it. It's called Spy Chips. We think it's a very important book. You really need to get copies of programs like this, of my interviews with Catherine, my interviews with Liz McIntyre, who's their partner, and you need to help us to get this information out. Now, there's some people who say, I don't care what the government knows about me. I trust my government. Well, I don't, and I believe that the history of mankind is the people who trusted their government eventually were destroyed by it. Our founding fathers feared government, In fact, Thomas Jefferson said, you know, speak not to be of confidence in men, but rather bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And, of course, he was going along with John Locke's idea that the government governs best, it governs the least. And so there were those people who, when they founded this country, restricted the power of the federal government so men could be free. And then we hear other people who say, oh, well, I'm not worried about it. Gee, I hope government will tell me. Or, you know, I'm eating the wrong diet so I can be healthier. My goodness, I would think you would know whether you're eating the wrong diet. On your own, you don't need government to tell you. Because I will tell you most of what the government's told us about health, encouraging us to eat trans fats and the wrong types of fats have generated more arteriosclerosis and suffering and death. Many of the vaccines that they're advocating are highly toxic and contain a toxic mercury. They know that. Those people who trust government, of course, do so at their own danger. If you'd like to get the books, buy chips, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. You can help us that way. We do carry a few products. We carry, actually, the Berkey products, and if you don't have a big Berkey or Berkey Light, why, you need to have one in case of emergencies, or if you're in an area with fluoridated water, and you've been drinking that fluoridated water too long, why, my suggestion is you get a Berkey or Berkey Light, and you begin getting the fluoride out. It will take the fluoride out, the vast, vast majority of it. And then, of course, we do carry health products. We carry all sorts of vitamins and minerals and selenium and magnesium and all the things my wife and I take, and we are offering these. If you'd like to get our health catalog, and if you'd like to get your products to us, it'll help us, and you'll be getting certainly the finest products, as far as we know, that they're made by the leading producer of health food products in the country, but it comes out under a RL label. You may be able to figure out who the producer is, but I can guarantee that these are good products. And then, of course, we also have long-term storage of food products. If you have not made arrangements to provide for yourself and your family in case of an emergency, and we don't know what the future holds, but I can tell you that I look to real calamities coming to this country because of God is just. His justice will not sleep forever, and it is not going to look kindly on a country that went into a war in Iraq, and somewhere between 100,000 and 900,000 civilians have been killed, and the president distorted the truth to take us into that war. He planned to go into the war long beforehand. If you doubt that, why, you need to read the book, The Price of Loyalty, by Paul O'Neill, former Secretary of the Treasury. You need to go, of course, to the Project for the New American Century website. And in 1948, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and the people who surround them, Paul Wolfowitz, were writing to President Clinton demanding a war with Iran. In 2000, they were demanding a war with Iran. The website, newamericancentury.org. Go there, read it, understand. The war with Iran was planned, and the president deceived us when he took us into that war. And he lied about that, and he says, of course, he doesn't condone torture, but he does condone torture. And he says that he doesn't believe in amnesty, but he does believe in amnesty. He says he's going to build a fence, but he's not going to build a fence. And furthermore, he says English should be the language, the official language of America. But if you go to his website, you'll find out that the president's website is available completely in Spanish. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Annie Jacobson, who's written a great book called Terror in the Skies. And she's been keeping tabs on what's happening to the airline industry as far as the terrorist threat is concerned. And recently, of course, we received something from her publisher commenting on the fact that there was a gentleman who was carrying bomb parts, and he went through airport security, he was checked, and carrying bomb parts, they allowed him to get on the plane. What's the background of that story, Annie?
Well, we're talking about an incident from this summer in Houston, where a man was allowed to get on a plane with hollowed-out shoes. And most interestingly, a lot of the attention fell on the 9-volt battery he was carrying. And this, of course, created a big debate. Many people say that is a bomb part, and others say it's simply a 9-volt battery, which brings me to the heart of the matter. I went to the TSA and got a little bit of a lesson on bomb technology. And I learned that a 9-volt battery is actually the only component that is necessary to power a small IED on a plane. So in that situation, I think the TSA was really doing its job.
All right, fine. Well, first, now, what about the hollowed-out shoes? And, of course, there were no explosives, were there? Or was there just the potential for that?
He did not have any explosives on him. But this instance, and why I wrote about it and what I found very interesting, is it really speaks to the heart of the matter of people jumping to all kinds of conclusions on both sides. And the situation was very clear that the man had components to build a bomb. And he was pulled aside, and he was asked, law enforcement was asked to step in. And the TSA made a decision to contact local police. And this is where I write one of the great problems lies in our airport security today, and that is the inability for our agencies to share information with other agencies. In other words, the TSA did not make the correct decision to go to the FBI, which is on standby in every airport that we have in the United States now. They decided to go with the local state police. One can only believe that this is a power struggle of information sharing.
Well, of course, we're here for all sorts of incredible stories. There was a program recently on CBS, 60 Minutes, talking about, of course, the terror a checklist that they have, with the names of potential terrorists, including names of, I think, 14 of the 19 hijackers who were supposedly dead as a result of the World Trade Center episode bombing, of course. But they had their names, they had their dates, so it wasn't a case of mistaken identity. Why would they have the names of all the dead hijackers on this no-flight list?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought this up, because I think that the no-fly list is a terrific example of exactly the kind of thing that Americans should be talking about, because it's very specific. We all experience the no-fly list every time we go to the airport. And the reason that those 14 of the 19 dead hijackers were on the list was because the no-fly list is in essence just simply all for show.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Annie Jacobson talking about Terror in the Skies. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about the no-fly list, and this was discussed, I thought, quite eloquently on 60 Minutes, as they pointed out that I think at least 14 of the 19 hijackers were there, and they had a lot of names of people who were dead. They had a lot of common names, but, of course, they didn't have any specific dates of birth, and so I think there was a fellow named Robert Johnson. In fact, there were about six or eight of them named Robert Johnson, who got hassled every time they went to the airport, and of course, just because they had the same name as some sort of a terrorist, but none of the other identification marks. They didn't look like him at all. They didn't have the right same age. So, but they were harassing all of these people, and Annie's suggestion is that no-fly list is simply a vehicle for making everybody feel that they're doing something. Is that pretty much your impression?
It absolutely is, and I think 60 Minutes did a terrific job unveiling that. And the way that they did that is a terrific example of what journalists should be doing, and that is getting access to these documents that the government wants the American public to believe are classified for reasons of national security, when in fact the reason that they're classified is in many cases to hide what is really going on inside the Department of Homeland Security. 60 Minutes got a hold of the no-fly list. They went over that no-fly list with painstaking detail, probably more so than the woman in charge of the no-fly list herself had ever done. And anyone who watched that 60 Minutes episode saw that. And therein lies a very serious problem facing the American public, which is that we cannot simply take what the Department of Homeland Security is telling us about our safety for granted. We need people like 60 Minutes accessing this kind of information so that they can ask the elected and appointed officials what kind of an excuse a situation like this is. And when you see that the no-fly list is, you know, has names on it like dead Nazis, for example, or the president of Bolivia, and it becomes painstakingly clear that this list was cobbled together in 2003, kind of an ad hoc, you know, just amalgamation of any kind of name of somebody who might pose a threat, put together, but most appallingly, not looked at since. And when we learned at the end of the 60 Minutes episode that the American public has been billed $144 million for the quote-unquote maintenance of this no-fly list.
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course the no-fly list that is being discussed was just brought out on 60 Minutes. If you didn't see the episode, you can actually buy the transcript, as I very often will buy the transcripts, directly from CBS, just to have them on hand and cataloged, although you can get at least a good part of that up on the Internet. But Annie was saying that this no-fly list has about 44,000 names on it. It was put together in 2003. To make us feel good. And it has cost us, what, $144 million?
$144 million was simply for the upkeep in the 3 years that had passed. And so, in other words, you would imagine that you have, you know, intelligence analysts combing over this list, keeping it current, taking off people that don't belong on it, and so on and so forth. And essentially what 60 Minutes revealed was nothing has changed from the moment this list was created. Most astonishing was the fact that the greatest known terrorists, some of the greatest known terrorists that are alive and well today, were not on that list. And the reason given why these folks were not on that list and therefore able to get on a commercial plane was because the intelligence communities didn't want to tip the hat to other foreign governments of who is exactly on our no-fly list. If that doesn't sound like something out of a George Orwell novel, I don't know what does.
it was almost humorous as this woman in charge of the no-fly list was being interviewed, I think it was by Steve Croft, and he was asking, or whoever the gentleman was who was doing the interviewing, but simply, asking, how come all these people are on this list? who are long since dead. Oh, well, of course, you know, a lot of people have the same names, and yeah, but, you know, you've got all these hijackers on there, and you've got the exact dates of all of their births, so why are these hijackers on there? Well, how do you know their name is on there? Well, because we have the list. Well, how did you get this list? Well, we got this list. It's supposed to be confidential, you know. She was quite upset they had the list. When it was obvious they had the list, why she tried to answer all these questions obtusely. And, of course, at least according to 60 Minutes, why 2 days after the interview she resigned from the FBI.
Absolutely, but probably not before the Steve Croft received a letter from the IRS, or at least Department of Homeland Security, pestering him about something. Because that is what our Department of Homeland Security does. They put, rather than fix the problem, they put their attention on attacking the messenger. And that messenger, in this case 60 Minutes, is incredibly important for the hallmark of democracy, which I think is at issue right now, I mean really in jeopardy, which is transparency. We have a Department of Homeland Security with its ever-increasing budget. It has gone up 6% in this year alone. Did you know that the fiscal budget for the Department of Homeland Security this year is $47 billion? I'm sorry, $42.7 billion. And with that, you get an enormous amount of executive power, and you get things like a no-fly list, which simply is all for show.
This is one of the most incredible examples of, you know, imbecility and of bureaucracy, and really, of course, an effort to convince us something's being done. Now, certainly, Annie, you are on top of what's happening as far as our pilots are concerned, that there's really a threat, you know, from Islamic terrorists hijacking our planes, and we're just doing everything we can to prevent this. Well, my understanding is that most of the airline pilots who've gone to all the trouble to actually take the training so they could carry a gun, and of course everything was done to discourage him from doing that, and then they put this regulation in that they had to keep the gun in a locked box any time the door was open and they were in jeopardy. When the door was to the cockpit was closed and there was nothing to fear, then they could have the gun out, but of course somebody was going to bring them food, they were going to get up and go to the bathroom, then you had to lock the gun away, and that was the only time it would do any good. And a lot of the pilots are just saying, why bother to carry a gun?
Well,
if they did everything they could to keep me from having it, what I would really need it to protect myself in the plane.
Well, this kind of thing fits perfectly into the George Orwell novel, along with the no-fly list idea. And these are the kind of things that, you know, I'm glad that you're discussing, because people need to really think through some of the concepts that are being put forth about our security. Because a lot of them you really find up winding in this catch-22, you know, only keep the gun out when you don't need it, type of an idea. But here's another one for you. You know, we had a very interesting, very disturbing summer of terror threats on our airplanes. Of course, culminating in August 10th, the disruption of the terror plot to in England to blow up as many as 10 jets simultaneously over the Atlantic Ocean. And after this event, there was 20 instances of flights being disrupted. 20. People called them false alarms. People called them all kinds of different things. But here's one I wanted to bring to your attention. There was a continental flight that was diverted because a ceiling panel was found missing in the bathroom. And when the flight landed, it was sent way out to the end of the tarmac, and everyone was searched, and the FBI immediately came out before they possibly had any time to do any kind of research, and they called this event a quote-unquote non-event. And this is one of my favorite Orwellian-type ideas that the FBI keeps putting out there. This is a non-event. Well, I asked around to some pilots, and I asked them what it means to have a missing ceiling panel. And they explained to me the dynamics of what is exactly behind that ceiling panel, which I've been specifically told by the TSA not to say on air. Now, again, this is an absurd concept because you could call up a pilot and ask him and he would tell you, and I would encourage you to do that. But you can imagine the mechanics of what is behind that ceiling panel, and you can imagine why a pilot would consider that a very serious event if someone was actually in the bathroom tampering with this in flight. And yet, the FBI says it's a non-event, and so people turn the page of the newspaper and move on.
All right. Well, of course, now, there are a lot of things that go out as far as the airlines are concerned. My understanding is, of course, that many of the air marshals are very, very unhappy. First of all, we don't have air marshals on most of our planes, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. The number is classified, one of the few numbers that probably actually should be classified. But we don't have enough air marshals, and the air marshals are leaving the service in great numbers.
All right, fine. Well, the figures that I've heard is probably 10% or less. Maybe they've classified it, but they don't want the American people to know that there really aren't air marshals on most of the planes that they're going to be flying on. Now, what about this idea that the air marshal had to wear, you know, a suit and white shirt and tie, which made him just stand out sitting there in the first-class area, which so that any terrorist worth his salt would know who the air marshal was? Have they changed that regulation at all?
You know, they did change it, but let me tell you the real story behind the dress code. And again, people should really be asking this question. The dress code was changed in September of 2006, just last month. And the dress code problems arose 4 years prior. 4 years prior, air marshals were writing letters to the director of the Air Marshal Service saying this is a threat to national security, because if a terrorist knows who an air marshal is, the terrorist can overtake the air marshal and then take over the plane with the semi-automatic Sig Sauer that the air marshals are carrying. Now, the only thing necessary to change that dress code was a pen being held in the hand of the director to sign on a piece of paper. That absurd policy could have changed overnight, and yet it took 4 years to change that policy. Not only 4 years, it took over 100 articles in the mainstream media. It took a 22-month-long congressional investigation, and it took untold taxpayer dollars. And for that dress code to change, which all it involved was a single stroke by the air marshal director.
Oh, why was he so loath to do something that was so logical and that would have really tended to protect the people on the plane?
And that is the national security question. And I write about this in my forthcoming book, which is the idea that there are many things the Air Marshal Service does not want you to know. So keep the public focused on this absurd dress code problem. Keep them writing about it. Keep Congress investigating about it. Keep all this money being spent, because we will keep the issues away from the real problems inside of the Air Marshal Service, which are mirrored throughout the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, can you go a little bit into what the real problems are? Because we've seen an occasional reference to it, as some of these men have risked their jobs, you know, to testify before Congress, trying to let the American people know that this certainly is just, it's all symbolism over substance. It's not there really to effectively protecting them. What are some of the real issues that we're not talking about?
Well, one of the main issues is that the air marshals are essentially prohibited from doing surveillance before flights. And this is the key issue that most law enforcement officers in the aviation domain will tell you is the key to preventing a terrorist attack, keeping eyes open before a flight. And yet the Air Marshal Service absolutely does not want its marshals doing this. And this is because of the very simple bureaucratic reason of they want the marshals on the specific flights, and they want them off the flights, and that is it. And if you see suspicious activity in the field, then you have to do an investigation, and then you might have to break your cover. And then it escalates into uncontrollable situations. And what we are seeing inside the Federal Air Marshal Service is an agency that wants to work like robots. And this is not conducive to winning the war on terror.
We almost have a feeling they're not really interested in winning the war on terror. What they're really interested in is giving the impression that they're protecting it.
They are absolutely interested in that, and they're interested in keeping their budgets what they want them to be, which is ever increasing. And the focus is going away from protecting the people, and it is moving toward looking good.
Well, I think this is sort of the way the government game is played. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Annie Jacobson. Her book is Terror in the Sky. She has a new one coming out. I can hardly wait. How soon will it be out, Annie?
It'll be out in a couple of months. We're working on the details.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Annie Jacobson. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about really what goes on as far as the airlines are concerned. Now, one of my large concerns is that, there's all this talk about, my goodness, you know, we've really got to do something about to protect the people there in the planes. And yet, until very recently, they haven't bothered to screen the cargo that goes on the planes, because most of the planes carry cargo, in addition, to the baggage people have. And they're not screening that, are they?
They're not screening the baggage. They're not. The TSA is notoriously about 2 years behind the curve of what they need to be doing in terms of preemptive action. And one of the great problems is that there's no shortage of good thinkers, but they seem to be overwhelmed by the bureaucracy. I'll give you an example. I was invited by the TSA to attend a bomb detection little sort of show at the airport, for lack of a better word, and they took me around and they showed me all the different equipment that they had, a lot of which focused on screening passenger bags for explosives. And I asked the federal security director at the airport when this equipment went into place, because of course we've been losing planes by bombs for decades. And the response was in the summer of 2004, after the two Russian airplanes blew up simultaneously. If you remember that, there were two women suicide bombers who assembled bombs in the bathrooms of those planes, and they blew up at the same time, killing everyone on board. And so after that happened, the TSA went into motion, spending $1 million per machine. Los Angeles Airport, for example, has 64 of these million-dollar machines alone. You can see the kind of money being spent on this, to address a problem after a major catastrophe has already occurred.
That was in 2004, because the initial attack was in 2001, so exactly. They waited 3 years to get around to it then.
Exactly, and yet this kind of threat has been going on for decades. Look no further than the London terror plot. Ever since then, everyone has been dealing with varying amounts of liquids being allowed or not being allowed in carry-ons. And yet, the liquid bomb threat goes back to 1994, when Ramzi Yousaf was perfecting his bombs for what would then be the Bojinka plot, which was the precursor to the 9/11 planes plot. And so the idea that suddenly in 2006 people couldn't bring toothpaste on board is a classic example of things being all for show. The threat was no greater then than it was at any time since 1994.
And, of course, the thing that really got to me about that was supposedly they'd arrested all the people who were part of this plot. Of course, many of them didn't have passports, and I don't think any of them had airline tickets. But, of course, we were told that there was this terrible threat. We had to keep everybody from taking fluid onto the plane, couldn't even take drinking water on the plane. But then already arrested everybody who was part of the plot. It didn't make sense.
Well, from my intelligence sources, it did make sense for a while, because there were originally five still at large. And whether they're still at large, that remains to be seen. But I do believe that was a very real threat. And the information I have is, in fact, that several of those plotters were flying back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean. And intelligence sources believe that they were doing test flights, because there's no other explanation or very little other explanation as to why these working class citizens of England would be, you know, popping back and forth to America all the time. So I believe that was a very real threat. How it was handled is a different story.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment here. And, Annie Jacobson is talking about the way they handled this flight. Remember this threat of the 10 planes being blown up. Annie believes that this was a very real threat. That, of course, that she believes that there were, has information that some of the people involved were flying back and forth over the Atlantic Ocean, about five of them making test flights. But then, of course, she says the way they handled this was inappropriate. So would you like to develop on this? This is the so-called 10 planes that were going to be blow up of the Atlantic. What was the real story there?
Well, before I tell you that, I'll give you one interesting note, which is that, circling back to the no-fly list, of those 20 Brits that were being watched by British intelligence and U.S. intelligence, none of them were on the no-fly list.
Well, of course, we wouldn't want them to know they were on the no-fly list, because then they'd know that we were watching them.
Oh, absolutely. And there you have it. But, you know, I recently read a book by Alan Dershowitz called Preemption, The Knife That Cuts Both Ways. It's a fascinating book, and it discusses how the United States needs to examine how the judicial system is going to handle preemptive measures against terrorists. Because we don't have cases in place that properly deal with this. And, of course, Britain doesn't have a constitution, so their way of thwarting this terror plot was very different than the way American intelligence could deal with it. And one of the interesting ways in which they interrupted this plot was by doing what are called sneak and peeks. And that is going into the home of the bombers when they were not there, and looking around at what they were doing. Now, that is certainly not something that would fly over here in the United States today. But that is the way that the plot was interrupted. So I think this is a really important book, and I think it's a really important subject, because we do have to begin to create a system to deal with these kinds of things, and at the same time, not take away the personal liberties and the freedoms that we also enjoy here in America.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, of course, the fact that they're really not checking the major cargoes. Isn't there a lot of cargo on many of the passenger planes that at least potentially could have bombs in them? And why aren't they checking the cargo that's put on the planes in addition to the baggage that's put on the planes?
Well, I must say that I am not an expert in the cargo, and I have a lot of pilots that bring up this issue, and it is a very big issue, and it is one that must be looked at, and maybe perhaps it's time for me to get a little more educated on this, because you're absolutely right that there's an enormous amount of cargo going in that is not checked. One of the ideas behind the U.S. intelligence not checking all this cargo is that the idea is that a plot on an Al-Qaeda scale would be planned in a large scale that would trump 9/11, so to speak. And cargo doesn't have a specific fly date per se. So terrorists would be working with an ad hoc schedule of when a bomb on a plane may or may not go off.
All right, that's
but that certainly doesn't take away the threat of a lone terrorist, you know, getting a bomb onto any plane that happens to be going out.
All right, fine. Well, that's some of the other things. One of the things that's really always disturbed me is the fact that if there were surface-to-air missiles, and certainly we know that Al-Qaeda would have access to surface-to-air missiles, we know that all Israeli Al-Al planes have deflectors on them to protect the plane in case of a surface-to-air missile. We don't have that thing on our planes. Why would that be? That would be, I would think, one of the first and most important things to do. If Al-Al, if Israeli airlines can do it, why can't American airlines do it?
Well, I wrote an article about the shoulder-fired missile threat, and it obviously is a very real one. There are something like 5,000 shoulder-fired missiles unaccounted for that the CIA knows about and is worried about. That's a very high number. Of course, there's been many plots disrupted of sting operations, FBI agents trying to sell shoulder-fired missiles to terror cells in the United States. So we certainly know the threat is there. We know the means are there. So far, no one has been able to actually launch one in the United States that we know of. Although there was an incident out here in Los Angeles, which many believe was possibly a shoulder-fired missile going at an American Airlines plane.
Well, of course, to say the logical thing would be to have deflectors on all of those planes, deflectors, so that if somebody did fire a shoulder-to-air missile, then, of course, the plane would have a means of defending itself. The Israelis think it's worthwhile defending their people. Why don't we feel it's worthwhile defending our people? And we'll be back to answer that in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here with Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Andy Jacobson. And, of course, we were just asking Andy why, you know, it seems the most logical thing in the world. I don't care if it costs a couple of billion dollars to put those deflector mechanisms on every one of our planes. We have them on our military planes. We should have them on our civilian planes. We should want to be doing everything we can to protect our civilians here in this country, exactly as the Israelis protect their citizens. So why wouldn't we even suggest doing that?
Well, the number of commercial airplanes that we have in the United States is, the Department of Homeland Security puts it, 6,800. And they, you know, it comes down to numbers. And they have decided that equipping all of these planes with the technology that you're talking about is not cost effective. The actual figure is that from RAND Corporation, which does a lot of work for the government, says that it will cost $11 billion.
Well, of course, we actually paid the families of the victims of 9/11. We paid them about $7 billion for the 3,000 people that had died there. I mean, if it's all right to give away $7 billion there, I think $11 billion to protect, you know, literally tens of thousands of American citizens might be money well spent.
$11 billion, but then you have the operating and support costs, which are $2.1 billion a year, and their overall prediction is $40 billion for the next 10 years. So that $40 billion would have to be allocated for that budget. And that's not something the Department of Homeland Security wants to spend.
Well, maybe they don't want to, but you could just put that on to the... I wouldn't mind paying an extra $25 for every flight just to know that I wasn't going to get knocked out of the sky, you know, if somebody had a surface-to-air missile.
Well, hey, we know they can spend the $144 million that they're not doing on the no-fly list. They can certainly pony that money over to the budget.
Anyway, of course, yeah, we only have to get $6 billion or so. Anyway, you know, this we shouldn't make light of this, but there's so many things are going on today that just don't make sense, and I think we have to be very, very concerned about the real lack of effort to protect the American people who are flying today. And so our guest today is, of course, Andy Jacobson. She's right on top of this. She's been studying it, talking to people, talking to pilots, and, of course, talking to the air marshals as well, although they're not supposed to talk to her. Why? She's got a great deal of information on what's really going on, and all this idea that they're really trying to protect us with, you know, all the lines we go through and, the, you know, have to take off our belt and take off our shoes, and how much of this is real and how much is it symbolism over substance. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Annie Jacobson. Annie, we do carry a book, but do you have a website or anything that you'd like to put out there?
Well, Spence Publishing, my wonderful publisher, I know they offer 50% off of the book if it is said that they were listening to your show.
All right, fine. So if you want to get the Spence Publishing, that's fine. Do you have a website at all you'd like to get people to?
Well, all of my columns about aviation security are on womanswallstreet.com. In my series, which is called Terror in the Skies.
And, of course, you actually were a reporter, and you did a lot of reporting on Wall Street before you got off onto this, didn't you?
That's right. I was happily reporting on business and finance, and then, of course, I was on a flight, the now notorious Flight 327, which is many counterterrorism officials believe was a dry run for a future terrorist attack here in the United States, very similar to the London plot. There were 14 Syrians on board my flight, and it is believed they were practicing building a bomb in the aircraft bathroom.
Well, then, of course, why wasn't anything done to apprehend them? Why didn't the FBI take advantage, you know, really track them? Why didn't they follow them after they got into this country? They didn't seem to do anything that was logical if this was really a terrorist threat.
Well, they didn't, but, I mean, the real clincher to the story came last spring when the government revealed that it had been investigating the flight that I was on since it landed for 22 months. They spent so much money investigating this flight, they had to go back to Congress for more money. And when they released the report this spring, they said, "Sorry, folks, we can't tell you what's in the report. It's classified."
That, of course, is what they always do, of course, when they don't want us to know anything. Oh, we have to classify it because we don't want Osama bin Laden living over there in the cave to know what we know about him and about his wicked plans.
And it's interesting because I've been writing about the classification process in the Department of Homeland Security. It's very scary. And, of course, Donald Rumsfeld often uses the example you just mentioned about our Army Corps manuals showing up translated into Arabic in the caves in Afghanistan. And that is a true story. However, it doesn't mean that everything that is going to wind up in Afghanistan, and it certainly doesn't mean that everything that the Department of Homeland Security does needs to be classified, although they certainly think so. The National Security Archive recently conducted an audit of the Homeland Security's use of SSI, and it is shocking. In one instance, they found that there is absolutely no requirement for any Homeland Security employee to be able to classify a document. In other words, anyone can simply say, this should be classified. So you can have these middle managers who come across a document which is embarrassing to them, and they can simply stamp it. It's actually stamped SSI, which stands for Sensitive Security Information. And I've written at great length that it really stands for CYA.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Annie, who's certainly one of the experts on this field, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And her book is Terror in the Skies. That's Terror in the Skies. It's a fascinating look behind what's going on today and really seriously questions how safe we really are when we're flying. If the danger that we're told is so very real and such, why, of course, why aren't they doing more to really protect us? So do you have any idea how many of the pilots really carry guns today since they made the situation not only so difficult to get permission but then so preposterous as far as actually carrying the gun on board and then not being able to have it when you're in danger and being able to have it when you're not in danger? How many of the pilots are really carrying guns? Do we have any idea?
We don't have any idea, and I'll tell you a small apocryphal tale. I was invited by the TSA this summer to go to Artesia, New Mexico, to the federal training camp there where pilots are trained to use guns. And I was really looking forward to this because I was going to get all kinds of interesting statistics on pilots and guns, although I was counseled by some of my colleagues that maybe it wasn't such a good idea, writing unfavorably as I do, to go out into the desert with the federal government and a lot of guns.
I'm glad that it turned out all right, or you wouldn't be here tonight. Go ahead.
Just a few miles from Roswell, by the way. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that carrot was dangled in front of me about this interesting trip. And then in one of my articles, I happened to have written unfavorably about some of the things that the TSA was doing. And my press pass, so to speak, to the federal training ground was suddenly, you know, taken from me. So the trip never happened. But I guess that's one of the repercussions of telling the truth.
I'm sure it is. Well, I appreciate everything you are doing, and I appreciate the fact that somebody is out there writing on these subjects. And I think it's so vitally important that our listeners understand that sometimes reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. And whether it be the flight list, the terrorist list that's at the every airport with the names of 14 of the dead terrorists on it and the names of a lot of other people, you know, I think the president of Bolivia, several other international people, you know, were on this no-flight list. And then, of course, the really significant terrorists, their names aren't on there because we wouldn't want anybody to find out who they were. Or we certainly wouldn't want the terrorists to know that their names are on the list. I know one of my friends is on that list, and every time he goes to the airport, they hassle him and he spends about 2 hours having to go through exactly all the same questions, you know, before they let him on the plane. We've got Robert calling from New York, and again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Robert, do you have a question?
Yes, Miss Annie.
Yes.
I'm a Vietnam era vet. And ask any Vietnam veteran about trusting the United States government.
Well, I think that there are many people who are very, very concerned about what happened in Vietnam, and people are concerned about what's happening now. Do you have a question?
The air flights, that one airplane that went over Long Island, they said it was struck down by a missile.
Are you talking about TWA 800, was that?
Yes.
I think it was
TWA 800.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was not proven that they tried to bypass and said, well, no, it wasn't any surface-to-air missile. But that was the only way for that thing to be exploding in the midair. They had hundreds of eyewitnesses that said it just flew out there, and all of a sudden, boom, it just blew up. But they said there was a trail of smoke that led up to the plane.
Yeah, well,
nobody wanted to believe them.
Well, I believe you're absolutely right, Robert. That's a little off the subject, but we have a couple of 4-tape sets with people who talked to all those witnesses. About 290 of them said they saw the surface-to-air missiles, but of course the government's response is, you've got to believe us, you've got to believe your lying eyes. Hey, thanks so much for the call.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. It's a little off the subject here, but if you have a question...
But it's an interesting subject, and I will add...
All right, go right ahead then.
Some of the folks that I interview for the work that I do are former Red Team members, and that was the elite group of anti-terrorist team that would look into, aviation problems, and that was born out of that flight. And these are folks working for the FAA, and of course they have a lot to say about that flight, and there's some really interesting books on that. You can read Peter Lance, you can read Jack Cashel's work, and I think it's really important for people to read those books and come up with their own ideas about things and stick with that, because I think it's important that we don't necessarily take a response that doesn't seem to quite fit the bill.
Amen. Well, we've certainly talked to a number of the people who actually were there and actually saw the missiles going up, and there was a very organized, orchestrated effort to keep the truth from the American people, even complete with a cartoon that they put on television, and I think we probably all saw it. It was made by the CIA. Now, why was the CIA creating a cartoon to be shown to the American people about a domestic plane that went down? I thought they were supposed to be overseas working. But anyway, of course, it showed this plane being exploding, the central fuel tank exploding, and then the plane climbing for about 3,000 feet before it turns and plunges into the ocean. And we know it was real because we saw it on television, or at least we saw the CIA's version of it. I always thought that was so interesting that they had made that, and they got that cartoon literally on every television station in America to create our reality. And it must be real because we saw it on television. Well, anyway, did these people give you any of their real impressions of what happened that time, or were they a little loath to talk openly about what really took place?
Most of the Red Team guys I've spoken to believe that it was likely a shoulder-fired missile. And again, it's hard to be conclusive because, an investigation wasn't done along those lines. And if you just dismiss an idea, it's impossible to really, prove an idea. But what I found fascinating was much of the Gore Commission was born out of that. And there was a lot of good work being done in international security ideas by the Red Team, and then they felt hamstrung leading up to the events of 9/11 by what they were uncovering and the huge gaping holes in aviation security that they were discovering thanks to the Gore Commission. But then, of course, they tried to report their findings, and these are whistleblowers, all of whom appear in the 9/11 Commission report, Bogdan Jakovic and Steve Ellison, and they felt that the biggest threat facing aviation security in America would be the breach of a cockpit door. So there's a lot of folks out there, former FAA members, who are really working hard to not see the same situation happen again. And my fear, and what I write about at great length, is that we will see another 9/11 unless many of these holes are dealt with.
And I certainly think that we have a very real threat to America. One of the things, of course, is that what they did really to reinforce the cockpit door was to simply put a bar on the inside of it. And what they should have done was simply put in a heavy metal door there that could not be breached. But apparently many of these doors, such as we have now, can be breached. In fact, I've understood that somebody had even actually taken one of the carts, you know, the coffee carts that they run up and down the aisles, and actually inadvertently just run it right through the door.
That's true. Although an ICE agent told me recently that the real solution to the door would be doing what El Al does, and that would be to simply not even have a door. The pilots enter the El Al planes through where the window areas are. They reconfigured all of their planes so that the pilots can only access the plane when it's on the tarmac.
I think that's, they're really, they face a very, very real terrorist threat, and I will give Israel a lot of credit for doing what is logical to protect their people. I wish that our leaders were as concerned about our safety as the Israelis' leaders are concerned about the safety of the people who are on their airlines. Well, let's go to Al, who's calling from Indianapolis, Indiana, with a question. Hi, Al, how are you doing?
I'm fine, and you folks?
Doing just fine.
Hi, Al.
We're getting freezing temperatures and frost on the window shields.
Well, of course, I'm not going to tell you what it's like out here in California. So you go ahead, Alan. Do you have a question for our guest?
Suffer out there. Suffer.
All right, right.
Anyway, I appreciate your concern and also the investigative efforts done relative to, air safety and with TWA Flight 800. Of more immediate concern are the shenanigans that are going on with the government and the protection of certain industries, such as the Five Sisters, the oil companies.
All right, well, does that have anything specifically to do with the airline safety? Because I certainly am concerned about the Five Sisters, as you are, too. But do you have anything specifically to ask about about airline safety?
If we direct, focus back into that area, what are we going to do in handling the flights that originate, from some of the questionable countries overseas that don't even meet, normal safety standards, and now they want to, long trip journeys, across the ocean, like the Atlantic Ocean, into our major metropolitan area.
All right, that sounds like a very, very legitimate question. Al's concerned about foreign flights coming in from foreign countries that don't have all the ability to check things out that we do and coming into our airports. Do you have any thoughts on that at all, Eddie?
It's a great concern, and the Homeland Security folks seem to be having a hit-and-miss approach to that. And if you remember, there was a KLM jet that started in Amsterdam. And, of course, Amsterdam isn't one of these vague countries that I know you're referring to, but I'll use this as an example. Started in Amsterdam, wasn't even going into the United States, was actually going to Mexico. But it had to go over American airspace, United States airspace. And when it did, it was denied by Homeland Security officials because there were two members or two individuals who had ties to Al-Qaeda on the plane, one of whom had flown with one of the hijacker pilots from 9/11 in Arizona. And so DHS simply said, you cannot enter our airspace somewhere as the flight was, over Canada headed to the United States, actually headed to Mexico. And that plane had to turn around and go back to Amsterdam. But that is an example of the ad hoc nature of a lot of this, because Homeland Security officials don't get the list of the airplanes until after the passenger manifest, that would be until 15 minutes after the flights leave most countries. And at that point, if you had terrorists on board who weren't going to politely be sitting in their seats en route, but rather had done something to hijack the aircraft, there would be nothing you could do to stop them short of shooting them down.
Amen to that. Okay, anything else you wanted to ask, Al?
just continue to investigate so we can improve our air safety.
And you continue listening to Radio Liberty. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest this evening has been Annie Jacobson. Her book, of course, is Terror in the Skies. Fascinating read, and it is available through either Spence Publishing or it's available through Radio Liberty. And after the when we let Annie go, why we're going to, of course, tell you how you can get it to us. And, of course, if you're interested in this subject or in many of the other subjects having to do with airline safety or in the tragic fate of TW-800, we actually have two 4-tape sets on this where you'll actually hear the interviews with the people who were there that fateful evening when TW-800 went down. And we even have a video, of course, goes into that, shows you the TSA hearings and how they absolutely refused to allow anybody who actually saw those missiles go up to testify. Well, Annie, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program. What's the message you'd really like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, the message today, I think, is that, you know, we have 25,000 flights a day in America, and flying is as American as apple pie, and I think people who love to fly should continue to fly. But I think that it is with that love of flying that people need to take their knowledge of what's really going on when they fly seriously. And the way to do that is to write to your elected officials. It sounds a lot more intimidating than it is. And here's the trick. Anyone with internet access can do this with a few clicks. You Google congress.org and you type in your zip code. And you will be given, in the blink of a mouse, email links to your appointed and elected officials, and you can send emails to people who work for you about the issues that really concern you. And I promise you, from someone with direct experience of just little old me winding up testifying for Congress, for example, that, you know, each of us has a voice, and that voice is very important. And always to remember that it's the people that really make up the government, not vice versa.
All right, fine. So you're suggesting that people write to the congressmen, and what should we tell them? What do we want them to do?
Well, what your issues are important. I mean, if you find the no-fly list an insult to everyone around you, then I think you should write that to your congressman, because congressmen and women pay attention to what their constituents say, period. And if no one says anything, they just move on to the next issue. You know, if you're someone who cares a lot about the Page scandal, you know, you're in a different camp than me. If you're somebody who wants to know why our Department of Homeland Security is spending so much taxpayer money without any kind of accountability, then that's the email I certainly send, and I encourage you to send that. But anything in between is important, because as individuals, we make up the United States of America. And as we see the Department of Homeland Security, which is part of the executive branch, getting more and more power, we see the legislative branch, Congress, you know, in my opinion, kind of squeaking away with its tail behind its knees, trying to do people-pleasing. You know, that's just my opinion, but I really feel like it's time for Congress to step up to the plate and muscle back against the executive branch, because that's what our founding fathers had in mind when they set up our three branches of government with our checks and balances.
Amen to that. And what we need, of course, are three branches that balance one another, not one that takes all power. God bless. Good night. Thanks so much, Annie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we do actually carry Annie's book. We think it's important. Terror in the Skies. If you'd like to get a copy, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we also have our 4-tape sets on the downing of TW-800. And then we have a video on the downing of TW-800. And, of course, you could just call and request that, but it's very well done. And you'll actually see, of course, the hearings that were held, and they were hearings of the Transportation Administration. And they, if you've ever seen them as a cover-up, they would not allow any mention at all of the over 280 people who saw the missiles go up, because we could not let the American people know the truth about that. Unfortunately, there's so much, of course, that the American people are not allowed to know about what's really going on in the world today. Now, I do not personally believe that the threat of Islamic terrorism and their hijacked airplanes is real. I think if it was real, they would, of course, have done something very effectively about it a long time ago. But they need to make us think that there's a problem. And that way, of course, we will go along with the government as they take away our freedom. You really need to understand that everything going on today was planned long ago. And back in 1996, Richard Haass, who at that time was in charge of planning at the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote an article for the Washington Post that has subsequently disappeared from the Washington Post archives, but we do have a copy of the article. His was reprinted at that time in 1996 by one of the Florida newspapers. And there he said, you know, the terrorist threat is coming. People are going to have to get used to long lines at airports. Remember, this is 5 years before 9/11. People are going to have to get used to long lines at airports. They're going to have to get used to long lines at government buildings. They're going to have to get used to increasing government surveillance and government phone taps and government searching our private premises. It was all planned ahead of time, certainly on the date of September 11th, the day of the attack. Why Richard Haass was in charge of planning at the State Department on counterterrorism, and of course today he is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and a member of that little elite group who really runs America called the Trilateral Commission. There's only 130 members of it, and yet they've controlled every administration since 1976. And if you doubt that, you need to get our September newsletter. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of that, or you can certainly go up on the Internet. And it'll be posted there probably within about a week or so. Well, you certainly can read our August newsletter, which will give you actually the same quotation. And we explain to you why we had to have an attack on September 11th. And, of course, I think Condoleezza Rice said it best. When asked at the 9/11 Commission, why didn't you do something? Didn't you know Al-Qaeda was a threat to us before the 9/11 attack? She said, well, of course we did. But the American people weren't ready. They were not ready to go along with this. What we needed was a catastrophe, so that people would change the way they look at things, so that people would change their values, so they'd be willing to accept government surveillance. And, you know, we did have that catastrophe. Donald Rumsfeld, on page 161 of the book, entitled Without Precedent, written by Thomas Keane and by Lee Hamilton. Thomas Keane's a member of the CFR. Lee Hamilton's a member of the CFR and for at least 10 years was a member of the Trilateral Commission. And they talked about Donald Rumsfeld. And Donald Rumsfeld was asked why nothing was done. And we said we were coming up with a plan. In fact, we'd been working on that plan for, you know, ever since we came into office. And in fact, the plan was completed on September 10th. The plan was completed on September 10th. You'll find that on page 161. Of Without Precedent. I think it's very obvious what happened. Don't you think so? Well, we'll be back here, of course, later. You'll certainly want to get the new videos we're carrying. Terror Storm, 9/11 Press for the Truth, the story of the Jersey Girls. You'll certainly want to get the video In Plain Sight and The Day That Changed America Forever. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Terror Storm, Press for the Truth, the story of the Jersey Girls, In Plain Sight, and of course, The Day That Changed America Forever. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is Tuesday, the 24th of October. And guess what? I guess the question's going all the way up to the president's office. A little backpedaling, maybe. A little reassessment, maybe. A change of strategy. Folks, I guess folks are starting to get it. Wait till you hear how the mainstream media is beginning to react to the Military Commission Act of 2000. Even Keith Olbermann can see it now. Yes, it's undeniable. It's irrefutable. There is a line in the sand. Do you see it? This is Dave Von Kleist.
And Joyce Riley, this morning.